Coming up, we've worked hard to bring you another great episode. You know what would make my day? If you listen, yes, but you can really make me smile by subscribing. You can go to offthenose.com or on whatever platform you're using right now. They all have that little subscribe button. Go there right now, click that, and boom, happy Kelly. If that's not enough, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Insta and Twitter. You can share the episode with your friends or colleagues. So many options to show your love. But let's just start simple and subscribe today, right now. Don't put it off. You guys rock. Hey, everyone. Today on the show, we have a very cool spiritual leader from the modern Orthodox world, Rabbi David Cohen out of New York. He is a guy wearing a lot of hats, has a very off-the-nose story for how he became a rabbi and the various pivots he's taken in his life. Just a super cool story. A lot of parallels to be drawn from the Jewish history to what we're dealing with today. And I guarantee you, you'll leave feeling a little more peace and love in your heart as well. Let's go. You gotta get it how it goes now. You gotta take it off the nose. It's off the nose. Gotta get back in control now. Let's stop believing in ourselves. It's off the nose.
I definitely did not grow up thinking I was going to be a rabbi. Actually grew up thinking I was going to be an attorney, which I actually did do for a period of time. But I will say that in my high school years, my maternal grandfather, who he himself was an inspired rabbinic leader, he would spend a lot of time in our home, and he was always kind of whispering in my ear, not that I should become a rabbi, but just that I should become a little bit more serious spiritually. And although it didn't necessarily resonate with me at the time, I can say that kind of at a later juncture in my life, when I did get a little bit more serious, I often did kind of harp back on those earlier years of my grandfather kind of whispering in my ear to maximize my time and do things that were more meaningful in contrast to what I had been engaged in, you know, in my youth.
Now, had it been your parents, you might not have listened, but the grandparents tend to get into our heads a little bit better, it seems, at certain ages.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I did listen to my parents in the sense that they really wanted to be. It's interesting. My mother growing up as the daughter of a rabbi. Back in those days, it was much more difficult to make a living as a spiritual leader than it is today, thankfully. And therefore, my mother had a little bit of a negative experience just because my grandparents didn't have so much. And she didn't want me to kind of have a similar experience. And therefore, she encouraged me to kind of pursue a legal career, which was something, you know, doctors and lawyers back in the day, at least in the Jewish world, those were professions that were espoused
solid.
And encouraged.
Solid, yeah. Secure, recession-proof, yes.
Yeah, in theory, yes. So, yes, so I did follow their advice to pursue a legal career.
Interesting. And so you went to regular school, undergrad, for religious studies?
So it's a great question. I'll just tell you how it works, basically. So I went to a Jewish day school in the New York area where I grew up, and I actually live very close to where I went to high school, interestingly enough, even today. And then, which is common in our Orthodox Jewish world, many of the students will then go spend a gap year or two gap years between college and high school studying like in a seminary in Israel, which was kind of really where I got inspired and turned on towards possibly pursuing the rabbinate or something of that ilk as I matured. And then I came back from Israel, 2 years in Israel, 2 years of study, and I went to Yeshiva University, which is a college that integrates or incorporates both religious studies as well as secular knowledge and study. And from there, I went on to rabbinical school. I also went on to law school, etc.
Wow. I would imagine just the history of being in Israel would move anyone, let alone, I mean, it's on my list, and it's probably my next trip is Rwanda and then Israel. Yeah.
I would highly encourage it. It's something exceptional. It's really something very beautiful and very special. Although I had visited previously with my family before I spent the year or two living there, those years kind of engrossed in study and the sanctity and the holiness of the land was transformational right. for me. And when I actually, interestingly enough, we'll get to it. I actually met my wife, fast forward about a decade. I met my wife while on a trip to Israel. And we began our married life and had our earliest children, our two eldest, we had them in Israel as well.
Oh, really? And then transitioned here.
Well, it's a whole, I mean,
that's a whole nother show.
Basically my first pivot was basically, I went to law school. I went to Columbia Law School here in New York. I then got a job at Simpson Thatcher and Bartlett, which was one of the big Manhattan firms. This goes back, I mean, this is 1998 when I was a summer associate at Simpson Thatcher and Bartlett. I started working there in 2000. I worked from 2000 to 2004 as an attorney, as an associate at Simpson Thatcher and then another firm, another similar firm. And at that point, I pivoted. That was my first major pivot, where I decided to basically put behind me corporate America and go off to Israel and go back to study in the seminary with the thought of transitioning to a career in the rabbinate.
So I can't imagine why working in law would cause you to maybe want to be more spiritual. Explain that to us.
That's a great point, Kelly. So, you know, the truth is, I really didn't know what I wanted. I was like many. I think I had, and even to today, I think I do a lot of things because I have a lot of interests. And law just seemed like a great starting point. But yes, it wasn't, you know, at the levels that I was on and the work I was doing, it wasn't particularly motivating or inspiring. It wasn't anything terrible. It wasn't giving me fulfillment and meaning. And I had kind of, like as mentioned, I had my grandfather in my ear, and I had these years in seminary, and I was like, you know, why not? Why not do something a little bit more meaningful?
Yep, that makes sense. No, you know, and so the pivot was scary because a law, you know, a career in law has financially rewarding path, and it's a more, you know, there's less probability for it to go wrong.
It definitely was scary. I mean, I left at that time. I don't remember what I was. Let me couch it like this. I think that, you know, on some level, like fast forward 20 years, like in Jewish communal work, I, you know, maybe was making what I had been making, you know, 20 years earlier as like a kid out of law school. I mean, so from a financial perspective, yes, to leave behind a very, you know, substantially paying job for basically nothing, because at that juncture, I didn't have like a new job. I basically was just going off to Israel to study again and kind of take it a step at a time. It was very adventurous of me, you know, at the time, but I didn't have a family. I wasn't married. The risks weren't that high, but it's something that, you know, yeah, like now that you mentioned that, it's kind of cool that I did that. I probably would never do that today, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, I took a pivot at 48. So we take pivots and you hope that you have the guts to do it. But as you know, and we see in life in general, as responsibilities add, fear comes with that, generally speaking, right? And some of it is just being responsible. We do need to, you know, put food on the table if you choose to have children and clothe them. So some of it is not just fear, but responsibility, and that does take money. But so I celebrate the pivot. I mean, in fact, kids in their 20s, I call it kids, but when you're in your 20s and if you're not taking the chance, then my God, I mean, you, so thank goodness you did that at that age. And you've never looked back since? No regrets?
Well, I have what to say on that. Before I get to that, I don't know if you ever listened to Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V. Do you know, you're familiar with Gary V? So he's always like pounding away at people at their 20s. He's like, 20s is when you should be trying stuff. 20s is when you should be building that business, you know. So that's for sure exactly like you said. I definitely agree. Do I ever have regrets or do I ever think back? I mean, I do think that we'll talk, you know, there were other pivots, you know, as things progressed, even in my serving the community. And there were times that were challenging financially and otherwise, where I definitely did kind of, you know, wonder to myself once or twice, you know, not why did I leave what I was doing, but maybe strategically I could have planned better to have kind of something going on the side, like a business or figure out some other way to support my family rather than just kind of relying on the community, because that that can be burdensome when you're relying on a community to support you.
Sure. And that passion that drives those pivots, you know, not every day is loving 100% of what you do. So there's some of those moments that are going to be tough and you're going to have adversity, which we're going to talk about. And so, yeah, those are those, I guess, quiet moments where you say, man, should I or shouldn't I have? But no regrets.
I think we definitely always, I think most people always kind of reflect or wonder the path not chosen or what my life would look like, you know, if I had gone that way. But I do think one of the important messages that I've learned is you always kind of have to, you got to look forward. You know, you can't look back. You can't correct the past per se, but you can move forward and do great things in the future and learn from your mistakes and
that's
pivot.
Right.
Like, so I think that's a great lesson.
I agree. So you are an expert on Judaism as a rabbi by studying and continue, you know, you're a scholar, attorney, as you mentioned, therapist, educator, an author. I know you wrote a book in 2016, a columnist. So you wear a lot of hats. So I think it's clearly qualified as an expert in Judaism. And, you know, I want to talk about how you can help the audience with everything going on today. We look at Jewish history and you celebrate Passover every year, which celebrates the freedom from being enslaved thousands of years ago. And I'm not going to pretend to understand Jewish history completely, but I certainly know some and I've attended several Passovers.
I'm impressed. Look at you. Great.
And tried to listen, you know, as I looked at the interesting food and learn. But I have always admired, I studied this faith a little bit in college. I've just always admired the Jewish culture. And I know there's people who become Jewish and there's Jewish from your heritage. So two different ways to think about it. But I've just always admired the Jewish people as a generalization. I never felt like they portrayed themselves as victims in any way. I've always thought of them as mighty and strong and together. And so what parallels can we draw from Jewish history to what is going on today? And do I have it right?
I mean, That's a lot there. I want to push back a little bit on calling me an expert. I don't know. Expert is a term that scares me. I'm flattered, but I'm definitely somebody that's perpetually growing and continuing to learn and continuing to study in both current events as well as history, world history, Jewish history. So I'm a work in progress. So I'm definitely no expert. But
well, hopefully we're all works in progress. I agree with you on that. Yes.
But that being said, I definitely have read a little bit and studied a little bit. And I really appreciate kind of your admiration for the Jewish people and their journey and their trials and tribulations. I think it certainly is something that we take to heart as a people. You know, when we look at the, you know, the struggles that are going on today in the world at large, in terms of what happened recently in Minnesota, the suffering, the historical suffering that the African American community, Black community has suffered, you know, here in this great country. But be that as it may, you know, there are mistakes that were made and obviously terrible things, and a lot of parallels. And I think that On an individual level, I have a lot of friends, you know, from that community. When I spent years in Manhattan, I used to hang out with a lot of people, you know, who are different than me, similar backgrounds, a lot of mutual respect, a lot of admiration. And I think there needs to be kind of an honest conversation, and there needs to be things that are done respectfully and the right way. We definitely, these two communities in particular, and I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking me, but you know, these two particular communities have a lot in common in terms of a shared history of oppression. But I do like the, I do admire the way that you kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, victimization or things like that can be, you know, can be difficult in taking responsibility and things like that in terms of what we can control and how we carry ourselves and how we communicate the messages that need to be communicated. I think sometimes are lost. I mean, we're you know, I don't want to step on any dynamite here, and this is obviously a powder keg. And it's certainly at the heart of a lot of the tension that's going on, you know, right now on top of a pandemic. But there's an individual, his name is Zach Banner. I actually want to give him a shout out. He's actually an offensive lineman on the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I'm sure you're following, you know, DeSean Jackson, star wide receiver for the Eagles, made some very unfortunate, you know, remarks on his Twitter social media this week about the Jewish people. And Zach Banner, who was an African-American, you know, black man, basically got up in response to his friend DeSean. And he basically, I couldn't say it better than he did. I was really so moved by his equating the shared experience between blacks and Jews and how much our experiences are similar, and how he was kind of giving a message to his brothers, saying that we can't step on other people's backs in our fight, you know, for equality, which really resonated with me. I think there's a lot of in common. I think there's a lot of great things we could do together, but there are obviously fringe elements or difficult or challenging elements that make things difficult to cooperate and work with as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, through this whole thing, I keep thinking, you know, it all comes back to the home. It just all starts in the home with grandfathers, you know, like yours, whispering the messages he was whispering, and family involvement. And families can look all different ways. Divorce doesn't have to mean, you know, your child is going to end up, you know, a degenerate. I mean, so to me, it's all about the different people in a child's life who are surrounding them with positive messages of hope, but in whatever that looks like, if it's two moms, two dads, if it's an aunt, if it's a grandfather, it doesn't matter when I say family. So the idea of broken family, I know there's issues there, but I just think of everything as it starts in the family. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Jewish faith is just so strong about family. Do you see that as a possible differentiation with the way Jewish people think about their history versus how the Black community is struggling to move forward with theirs?
So I can't speak to the Black community in that regard, because I just, you know, obviously there are certain stereotypes, so there's certain presumptions, you know, that you see in the Black community, but I'm not well-versed enough really to fully appreciate or understand kind of, and I know there are a lot of amazing, you know, Black families, so on and so forth. So I don't want to really comment in that direction, but I would comment that, you know, family, yes, is something that's essential in the Jewish world, in the Jewish community. It's something that we put a lot of emphasis on, even when it comes to vis-a-vis the role of women, which is actually an interesting discussion within the Jewish community. My wife is a powerhouse. She's a midwife. She's a medical professional. She went back after having four kids to become, to become educated in these fields. And often she'll lament kind of, and it's something that's talked about even in the Orthodox world, which is the world I'm part of, which is, it's not to be confusing. It's the most conservative segment. It's not conservative Judaism. It's the most conservative segment of the Jewish world. And there is kind of a little bit of pushback at times in terms of the role of women in our community and where they express themselves. And I read something just
rabbis, correct?
So in the Orthodox world, that's correct. Yes. So but on that point, so we were talking, I was reading something just over this past weekend over Shabbat, and it resonated with me in the sense that the author was making the point, because we just had to shutter and close our synagogues for, you know, 3 months here in New York, which was terribly traumatic. I'm actually writing about that right now. And it's something that, you know, that this author was making the point that, but in the Jewish world, synagogue is not the main place, which is very jarring at first glance. And he was making the point that the home is actually the main place. And he was saying, even though women, for whatever reasons, that would be a whole podcast unto itself, why women can't be rabbis in the Jewish faith, at least within Orthodoxy, but the women are the rabbis of the home, that I can tell you for sure. Meaning the women are the foundation, they are the rock, they are the bedrock of the home. Now, besides working outside the home and doing all that they do to help support the family as well financially, they are the rock. I mean, I'm just observing anecdotally the families I see, the women are the ones that keep it together. They're the ones who know all the details of how things, you know, from building the swimming pool in the backyard to making sure each kid has exactly what they need. I mean, our women are incredible. Women are incredible. And it's something that the reason why the family is so strong within the Jewish community is because we're fortunate to have incredibly talented women that kind of keep it all together and keep us together.
Yes. Have you noticed a change over the years, you know, millennials and then forward, in relation to family time or spirituality? I mean, maybe in the Orthodox sect, not as much, but do you notice any pushback and change, you know, with social media and all the pressures?
Sure. You'd be surprised, meaning that maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't be. But yeah, it's certainly, you know, I'm not part of the ultra-Orthodox, you know, most rigid sects of Orthodoxy. I'm kind of more of the modern Orthodox, which is kind of more of a mainstream centrist perspective and view. Certainly our young adults, our kids, our millennials are exposed to the world, you know, in its fullest. And look, with the challenges of social media, the exposures, the kind of, you know, it's all about me mentality that's cultivated in society, you know, at various points. It's tricky. It's for sure to get our children, to get our young adults, to get our, you know, within the pulpits I've worked in, I've tended to work with young millennial type individuals. Just happens to be that those are both as a congregation in on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, as well as here on Long Island in New York. Yeah. I mean, you see, there's a constant challenge to engage our membership spiritually, to get them to want to go to classes, to want to study, to want to pray. These aren't things that are, you know, they're, even if they grew up with them, people get turned off and people get distracted by all different types of things. And it's not a simple task.
Do you have a whole book of gold stars that you're constantly handing out to the millennial? That would help.
Yeah. You do, like, it's all about relationships at the end of the day. You know, people of different faiths, people of different colors, it doesn't really matter. You know, at the end of the day, if you connect, if you can have meaningful dialogue, right? We're new friends here. You know, hopefully we'll continue our relationship. At the end of the day, you meet people, you connect with them, you're inspired by them, you hear their story, you're able to genuinely listen, to hear what they have to say, where they're coming from. There's so much more that binds us than that divides us. And look, America is a country that I've always had great pride in. And I grew up here. I very much feel, you know, part of the fabric of this country. I've been in the White House, both in the Obama administration and in the Trump administration. I've had the opportunity to visit both Democrats in the White House, Republicans in the White House, meet with our leaders. At the end of the day, like, we all want the same thing. We all want to live in a country that's thriving, that's peaceful, that's economically vibrant, that gives us a better future. I think, you know, when things kind of go awry and things are not happening the way we want them to happen, so then a lot of, you know, frictions come up and tension come up and so on and so forth. But I think at the end of the day, everybody wants the same. Most people want the same things.
I couldn't agree more. And I think you make a valid point that it doesn't really matter. I mean, that is the point. I mean, some of the negative conversations happening right now I feel are segregating us even more. It's sort of like, yes, you want acknowledgement of the past and issues, but sometimes it almost feels like we're creating more racism and more attention to differences. It's so interesting because if you look at children, I know you have five, so I'm not sure of the ages, but do you have any younger than teenage?
Yeah, sure. I have a 15-year-old, I have a 13-year-old, this is embarrassing. I have an 11-year-old, I have a 8-year-old, and I have a 4-year-old. So,
well, this isn't recorded or anything, so you can't even you said their birthdays.
My wife usually doesn't listen to my stuff, so thankfully. Because
perfect. Kindness. Yes. The point I was making is, you know, the younger children, like, you know, my niece and my sister is a third grade teacher, and even my kids who are 20 and 17, I try to have these discussions with them about what's going on in the world, and over and over and over, they keep saying, this is all stupid, okay? Maybe not the best choice of words. My niece doesn't say that. She says, I don't know what they're talking about. And my point is, these kids have been raised, at least mine have, and my niece and the younger kids don't see color. And now we're trying to talk to them about color.
Right.
So it's kind of confusing, you know, because certainly my kids, because they're older, they're going to be much more direct. And they're just, when they say it's stupid, what they mean is, you know, we don't have a problem. It's all the older people that have the problem.
I happen to agree with that. I mean, you know, I'm well into my 40s and closer to 50 than I am to 40. We'll leave it at that.
And, hey, I hang on to the 40s comment.
No, for sure. But I, you know, the truth is that I, you know, for me also, like, you know, I never saw, to me, color was completely irrelevant. But, and I compare it to the world of disability that I operate in as well, where, you know, there's a whole language of special needs children. There's a kind of a beautiful language that we've constructed over many years. Advocates have worked towards that. But I'm not naive, meaning I recognize that the generations that preceded me, like the generation before me, talk about, you know, children with disabilities using terminology that we'd find repugnant. And similarly, the earlier generations, I would be lying to you if I didn't admit that I've heard, you know, people that I'm close with or I admire refer to African Americans at times in ways that are not appealing or inappropriate, or they were not brought up with the education and with the refinement, and basically just it was a different world. You know, I didn't grow up in that world, and I'm in my 40s. That's saying so we've come a long way. I think we have come a long way. At the same time, and certainly the next generation, what you're describing, your kids and niece, etc. So for them, for sure, you know, they don't have this. But again, we're dealing with issues that have been kind of deeply entrenched in society for a long time. And even though there's been tremendous improvement, when you have an event like we had in Minneapolis, you know, I don't know what it was now, a month, 2 months ago, that it brings up old wounds. You know, it really brings out the old wounds. And again, I think people deal with it differently. You know, I think different people deal with it in different ways. But sometimes, you know, sometimes things are unleashed in ways that are unhealthy. I mean, here in Manhattan, I mean, just to see the pictures of the rioting that was going on and the boarding up of these stores, it's appalling. It's really appalling. It's frightening. And there is a certain political correctness of not being able to speak out about it. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic, for God's sake. And, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, members of my community, I think that on the one hand, there is an alignment and there is a sensitivity toward mistreatment. And I think we definitely support, you know, the Black community in that regard. But at the same time, there did seem to be like a, you know, members of my congregation were very upset about the double standard when it came to, you know, government officials just kind of letting, you know, people run roughshod and out the window with social distancing, out the window with masks. And here we're locked out of our prayer sanctuaries for months on end, and we can't, and our kids aren't in school and so on and so forth. I mean, there was a real incongruity there that angered members of my community, and it's very hard to explain it.
Sure. It's sort of like It was so egregious what we all watched for 8 minutes and 46 seconds that we just didn't want to say anything about anything for a while.
Right.
And the streets just rioted, and it's almost like the rule of law just went away just because nobody knew what to say. I think it was shocking in 2020 to see that, because I do think there's been so much change and there's so many programs and there's so much acknowledgement. And to me, the biggest thing is what is in the hearts of our kids. And the hearts of our kids don't see color, as a general statement. So to me, that's the best. And I understand systemic, and we have to make sure that there is equality and, you know, opening businesses and getting homes and all these things. And so it's good. It's good. It's good to check those boxes and make sure we have diversity. But I'm hoping that we are settling down a little bit and some of the emotion will calm and transition into conversation.
I hope. I hope. I agree with you.
For that.
I agree with you that there look, you know, but I'm willing to acknowledge as well that where you sit, where I sit, you know, we haven't experienced what's being experienced in the same way. So I'm willing to kind of acknowledge that it may not be fair for me to opine on it, but I just kind of wish, I just assume or imagine that there are different ways to communicate your point than the lawlessness and just complete pandemonium that erupted here in the middle of a terrible pandemic that was really, 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 really still is, you know, a great, great challenge. So we live in challenging times, that's for sure.
Yes, I'm sure you're seeing the anxiety and fear that everyone is seeing. What are you telling those that you have the opportunity to teach, coach, educate? What's your message?
So I could definitely tell you that, you know, one of the things I do is I have a private practice, a therapy practice where I have, you know, private patients and clients. And sadly, you know, my business has been booming in the last few months. I've gotten many more calls than usual for therapeutic intervention. So that's telling in and of itself. But in my more communal role, so I definitely am, I'm seeing the anxiety. There's no question. There's heightened anxiety. People, there's a beautiful saying from Viktor Frankl, who was a survivor of the Holocaust. He wrote an amazing book called Man's Search for Meaning. And he says in that book, he says that, you know, when people act abnormally in abnormal circumstances, that's normal. Meaning, so abnormal behavior in abnormal circumstances is normal. So I actually thought that was brilliant, because you're seeing a lot of people just kind of, look, people cooped up. And that, look, I'm fortunate. I really am blessed. I have a lovely wife, a lovely family. For me, it's the greatest thing in the world to be locked up in my house for 3 months and spend time with my family and be able to focus on them and kind of pause and, you know, and win the pause and kind of reorient myself and re-energize and refocus. There's so many great things that came out of things that were beyond our control. But I obviously am more than keenly aware that that's not the case for many people. And when people were finally kind of let out of their homes, I've seen a lot of just behavior that, you know, would surprise you. But at the same time, it's understandable, because I try to listen. I try to validate. Meaning that everybody's experience is unique and everybody's pain is unique. And there's a lot of loss that happened through this pandemic, you know, loss of life, first and foremost. I had people I was very close with who passed away in the early days of the pandemic. Mm. I was watching last night, there's a wonderful documentary on Netflix. It's actually about Lenox Hill Hospital. It's a fascinating documentary. And they had, the last episode was actually a 30-minute episode about the early days of the pandemic in the hospital and the pain and the anguish that the doctors were going through. So, you know, we forget about that, but it actually just happened like a few months ago. People think that happened 3 years ago. That happened like 3 months ago. And it's very much still on the radar. There's a post traumatic stress, you know, aspect to it. And then there's the financial. And then even if you didn't lose your job or et cetera, there's opportunity lost and cost. And it's the unknown that's still in the middle of this. And nobody knows when or where. It can say whatever you want. Nobody really knows where this is heading. So there's definitely, I just try to validate. I try to listen. And I try not to be confrontational or judgmental with people in this vulnerable state.
Is this when spirituality is needed more than ever?
It certainly helps. Meaning, you know, there's a saying that people often point to. They'll say, you know, when we talk, at least in our religion, in terms of relationship with God, it's a big concept. We believe in an intimate, deep relationship with God, that God cares about us personally, that he's involved in each of our lives. So we often, when we're trying to talk to people about prayer, we'll often communicate that you kind of like, you want to have an ongoing relationship so that when you really need it, it's there, as opposed to like, God is there for us all the time. And you can ignore him and neglect him all you want. He'll still be there for you. But it's kind of like, it's very different when you have built up a lot of goodwill. And now you're kind of coming to him, you know, in your time of need. That kind of, you know, so in the sense that spirituality as a mantra, as something that is something that can enhance one's life, whatever religion one may be part of, that's something that I think is valuable all the time, you know, pre, post, mid pandemic. That is something that's, I think, of tremendous value, of kind of going beyond ourselves, of understanding there's a higher being, of understanding that there are things beyond our control, that we're human beings, that we're finite. These are ideas that I espouse perpetually. I think if one exercises them and hones them throughout their life, so it makes dealing with particular challenges, in this instance it's a pandemic, but many other challenges that one may confront in their life, it makes it easier because it's in the framework or within the rubric of understanding that there are things I don't understand, there are things I don't control. If I, on the other hand, think that I run the world and all of a sudden I don't, that could be incredibly traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You mentioned your work with disabilities. I know you have personal experience with one of your children. How did you, and you work for, about inclusion, of course, you know, with disabilities, how did you go about teaching your child to celebrate? Is it a daughter or son?
So our eldest child, our oldest son, he's 15, so he has Down syndrome. Yeah.
He has Down syndrome. So how do you go about teaching all of your children to celebrate his differences? And how have you had some success with inclusion within the Jewish community as it relates to disabilities?
So thank you for asking that question. And talking about a pivot, I mean, that maybe, you know, if I think about it, if I frame it, that probably was the biggest pivot of our lives. We got married, nice young married couple living in Jerusalem. Life is great. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, unexpectedly, we go through a pregnancy and we're informed in the hospital a few minutes after his birth that this is not a typical child. And that was something that was really, I mean, I had some exposure, frankly, to children with disabilities because I had worked as a counselor in a camp many years prior with special needs children. So I had some exposure, but it's a whole different world when it's somebody else's child and when it's, sure, you know, when it's your child. And look, we always were, you know, open-minded type people, inclusive type people. At the same time, we definitely were academically rigorous and intellectuals. And it certainly was a marked shift to suddenly kind of realize that the child you have is not maybe the child that you would imagine. But I learned one really powerful thing in that time frame when this first happened, and that was, you got to take life one day at a time. One day at a time. It's such an important lesson. You know, I was thinking about, after the birth of my son, I was thinking about what was going to be 20 years ahead, 30 years ahead. That was giving me a lot of anxiety because you can't, you know, that is a recipe for anxiety. Meaning, take it one day at a time. I tell my wife this all the time now. We're talking about like, what's going to be? Are the kids going to go back to school or not in September? No, I have no idea. That's obviously a biggie. But at the end of the day, I'm like, you know, it's July, I don't know what it's today, July 13th, like one day at a time. You know what I'm saying? Like live in the moment, live in the moment. Carpe diem, seize the day, live in the moment. That's something that we talk about. In terms of your question, in terms of inclusion as a value, in terms of inculcating that within the community. So our son is he's great. He's very, very high functioning. He's very, very dynamic, charismatic, very beloved in our community. Very beloved in the communities that we've, you know, served previous to being where we are now. And he just has a, what we call in Jewish parlance in Hebrew, it's the word is called chen. It just means like a charm. It means charm. And because he has this warmth and this charm, so people are attracted to him. People enjoy talking to him, including him, giving him opportunities to participate in services when he can. And he does that and he models that. And I hope that we model inclusivity. I hope, you know, sometimes this is emotional for me. I think sometimes, you know, you don't realize the impact you're having. I always imagine like, you know, one day, you know, after 120 years of life, I hope a long life, I'll go to the heavens and God will show me, you know, the impact I had in scenarios I never imagined. So I hope that the way we raise our son, the way we've incorporated him as kind of one of the guys and one of the gals, we have one daughter, four boys, like he's just like everybody else in our family. I hope that's a model for other people. I hope, you know, we don't really teach it as much as hopefully we model it. And we're a relatively healthy family. We, you know, we try to do the best we can with God has granted us and blessed us with. And we hope that that models for others, that people that may be a little different, you know, they, at the end of the day, they be externally look a little different, but on the inside, they have a pure soul. They maybe have a purer soul. And there's a lot that can be gained from everybody, right? We say, if I could just add one last thing, we say in one of our Jewish sources called Pirkei Avot, which is it's called the Ethics of the Fathers. It's one of the Tanaic sources that comes from the Talmud. So we say, Ezehu Chacham, who is, I don't know if you've ever had Hebrew on your podcast before, but this is always the first. So Ezehu Chacham, who is the wise person? Halomed mikol adam, somebody who is able to learn from every human being. Person who can learn from everybody. Everybody has what to teach us. Doesn't matter what they look like, as we talked about earlier. It doesn't matter what abilities or you know, lack of ability they have. At the end of the day, we're all part of the human experience and we all can teach each other great lessons in life.
Oh, we need a lot of that right now. We need so much of that. That's amazing. I think I would love to meet him. That he sounds awesome. I love the word charm. That was really neat. And you get to do this. This is your, I don't want to call it your primary job, but I mean, you are working with children and disabilities through this group.
It's called Yachad, which is actually a Hebrew word. The Hebrew word yachad means together as one. So in English, it's Y-A-C-H-A-D. So you're absolutely right. That is my primary job. I do a lot of other things kind of on the side, a little bit here, a little bit there in my free time. But at the end of the day, my main position actually is a senior relationship officer at this amazing organization that basically services our community throughout the United States as well as in Israel. We lend tremendous support to programming for kids with disabilities, for their parents, for their siblings. I probably would not be working for this organization if I didn't have a child who actually had a disability, because that opened up to me kind of the power of what Yachad does, of what being together does, and the services that we offer and bringing out the beauty in each of these children. But I actually, interestingly enough, my role is a little bit more entrepreneurial in the sense that my role, and this was a pivot for me as well, a number of years ago, after serving a major pulpit in Manhattan for about a decade, I transitioned actually to work at an organization called Yachad, which is actually part of the Orthodox Union umbrella, which is a major, major, like the primary organization in the Orthodox Jewish world. And we're one of the branches of that union called the OU. And I actually took on a fundraising role. So it became very, although I don't directly work, people often call me for help or for getting their kid into a program. So I often say that I help support the programs. I help raise the funds to ensure that our programs run. We have a whole team of programmatic people that work, you know, on the programmatic end. So I actually have the, I have the great privilege of partnering with affluent individuals, individuals who care a great deal about making an impact in the world at large. And that also ties into my podcast, actually. I launched a podcast recently called the JPP, the Jewish Philanthropy Podcast. We've broadened it recently during COVID. Philanthropy doesn't just mean giving money. It means giving of yourself. And yeah, we've talked to a whole array of guests. But at the end of the day, my primary role is to raise the resources, the desperately needed resources, to ensure that we can continue servicing this community that needs our help so much.
Well, it's interesting. I did an episode on giving, and we've given more during this corona pandemic than any other natural disaster that's happened in history. And I find that interesting. Are you first of all, is there nothing better than giving?
It's
slightly selfish. I tell people this and they just kind of look at me. But when you give, you get so much more back that I'm a little perplexed when I give. I was just over at the food bank last week and I walked out and I felt amazing. And I was like, wait, this is not supposed to be about me. But you do feel that way.
That is the secret to success as a fundraiser, to understand what you're doing, meaning that you're giving people joy. I'm not taking money from people. I am giving them something that money can't buy. Well, money can buy. I mean, money can buy it, but it's not something like buying a car or buying a house or buying whatever toy you may want to buy. It's about buying meaning, making a difference, making an impact.
That's
and
right.
That is a privilege. And you can take the richest person in the world, you know, they can't buy that feeling unless they're doing something meaningful with their resources. And that's the opportunity. And Kelly, you're 1,000% right. That is, I had a mentor many years ago when I was in my rabbinical training. He used to always he'd always pile on me. He'd give me like tons of opportunities or challenges to speak, to teach. And then he would always end by saying, "And David, you know who gains the most from all of this? You do." Which I thought was actually very, very powerful, because, and it's good to be selfish in that regard. Meaning nobody does anything in life, I find, for the most part, purely altruistically. There has to be some pleasure in it for the person, or what doesn't motivate them. You know, you need to have. But what you were describing is absolutely accurate. Meaning feeling good that's the feeling that's supposed to come from giving. People who haven't really developed the giving reflex, so they don't really appreciate, understand. That's why they look at you like you're an anathema. But the truth is that those who understand the secret, it's transformative. There's nothing greater, nothing better.
There is nothing better. Does your son, do you get to take your son to work?
So, you know, we used to do, I mean, with Corona, we don't do this so much anymore, but I often, you know, before this all happened, I traveled a great deal. I would go around the country and speak in different locales and speak about the work that we do. And there were opportunities occasionally where I would take my son with me and kind of, you know, a little show and tell, a little like giving people the feel for the real life impact of the work, you know, that we do, that it can make. I try to do that with all my kids. Some of them are still giving me a hard time because I owe them trips, because we had trips that were canceled. But
they went the full trips. Yeah.
Well, no, but it's, you know, it's spending time with your kids. You know, you mentioned you have children who are, I think, 17 and 20. So as they get older, you know, they kind of get away. It can get away from you a little bit. Like when you still have them when they're little.
Oh, yeah.
Now's the time to really kind of to milk it and to spend time with them as much as possible. So I really enjoy doing
it. Absolutely. You know, they just see, hopefully they see you passionately working, but sometimes they don't see the excitement. And so, yeah, I remember when I took my older son to watch me do a speech in New Orleans. And, you know, he was 16 at the time. And so let's just say, I don't know, he wasn't my favorite every day. And after that speech, he looked at me in a different light. It was really interesting. I think the reality of the work, because with technology, they just see you on a computer. They don't understand how you touch people, how you affect people, how, you know, I ran a big company before this. And it was when I saw people do things on their own, think little seeds maybe I helped plant, and then I saw their success. That's what did it.
Right.
You know? That's what did it. It wasn't the numbers. I mean, right. The board wanted the numbers, but that's not what drove me. But my kids just saw me always on the computer, so they never got to see those moments. So I think that's really special when your kids.
They didn't get to see the impact. Yeah, I read about you know that you were a big CEO and did a lot of big things. I was drawn to that. I was kind of thought that was pretty cool actually, how you pivoted, and I saw that you would speak in various conferences. So I think that's very impressive, and it's beautiful to hear kind of how you took great pride and the impact that you've made. And I think that's a great lesson. I mean, we want to be able to model for the next generation to understand kind of, yeah, we do all the stuff because we have to, and there's computer work and there's bills to be paid, etc. But they, you know, but they should really see, where the real joy is. And we're fortunate, besides the work I mentioned, traveling on behalf of the organization I work for, but even in communal life as a rabbi, all the years I've served communally as a rabbi in different pulpits. So my kids have, you know, we bring people into our home. We have on the Shabbat, on Saturdays. So we used to have guests very frequently.
And we, they're, now they're in hazmat suits, but they come.
it's tricky. But, you know, when the Jewish holidays come around, so that's also a time when we often would go speak in different hotels or different programs. So our kids very much are part and parcel of being the rabbi's kid. So they know that there's something unique or different about that. So that's another beautiful piece of it that they can kind of, you're right, but they don't always see the impact. It's interesting. Like you're right. Sometimes the biggest things we do, they don't always see. So that's an important part. I like that feedback from you. I want to keep that in mind to make sure that they're kind of seeing at the end of the day, what it's really all about.
Right. What it's really all about. Well, and I think I saw your daughter. Wasn't she on one of your podcasts?
Yes. So we just for fun, the last few weeks, just kind of shaking things up. So I did a podcast with two of my childhood friends, which was really like a lot of fun. And then I did a podcast with my daughter. I actually had my daughter, we flipped the script. I had my daughter interview me on the JPP.
And, did you approve those questions ahead of time?
I work with her on some of the questions. Yes, we had a great time. It was really our extended family loved it. I mean, I don't know what the feedback was from other people, but our extended family were like, they got such a kick out of it. I mean, it was really,
yeah, I think it's a great idea.
It was precious. I only have one daughter, so like she's really precious. So she's away in sleepaway camp right now. I think hopefully she's doing well.
Yeah.
So, daughters are extraordinarily special, and you know, I was blessed with one, so we try to have a very, very tight relationship.
Well, I feel moved, and I'm glad that there are a lot of you out in the world, both in the Jewish faith and in all faiths, continuing to spread, you know, this kind of message of inclusion and positivity and perseverance and taking the pivot. And I think if we can have more people like that reminding us and pulling back some of the emotion and having more conversations with people like you, we have a fighting chance. I wanted to see if maybe we could end with a prayer. Can you wish, we've done some Hebrew. I mean, I'm not sure what to title the podcast. It might be a little Hebrew lesson, but there's got to be some words of peace and love and inclusion, and may we just continue to not see differences in a negative way and celebrate them.
So I'd love to give, thank you for this opportunity. Thank you so much for this whole interview. It's been a great experience. I really enjoyed talking to you, Kelly. It's been great, and continued success with your show and with all that you're involved in, all the great work you're doing. You know, in the Jewish faith, we find ourselves right now in a very inauspicious time period. We're actually in a period called the 3 weeks, which is a period in our history. We began today talking about Jewish history. It's a period in our history where we commemorate the destruction of the temples, two temples that were built in Jerusalem that were destroyed by the enemies of the Jewish people. And our sources teach us that the second temple was actually destroyed because of baseless hatred between brothers. We're not talking now about different races. We're talking about Jewish people who harbored ill will towards their brothers and sisters. And we're particularly sensitive in this time of the Jewish calendar to kind of flip the script, right? That the task that I know my people are focused on right now in this 3-week period on the Jewish calendar from the 17th of Tammuz till the 9th of Av, which goes till about the end of July, really, I think till about July 30th right now, is a period of, it's a period of mourning, of M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. It's a period of reflecting on our past, reflecting on where the responsibility lays with us in terms of tragedy or travesties or things that have happened to us. We very much believe in taking responsibility and taking ownership and understanding that, you know, yeah, there may be times we can blame other people and there's room for that and there's time for that. But at the same time, we always have to introspect and see kind of where we maybe have gone awry and where we can refine or correct and therefore kind of enhance the world in which we live. So my prayer or my blessing is that this should be a message that extends not just in the Jewish community, but really to the entire world at large, that we need to take this difficult period that we find ourselves in the world, in world history, a period of pandemic, a period of racial strife, a period where many people feel just kind of just disassociated, disenfranchised, disconnected, filled with frustration and anger. It's really a time where at the same time, there's always a lot of room for blame. And we can blame from today till tomorrow, but every person has to also take responsibility. And my prayer is that we each introspect, we each reflect, we each fix what we need to fix so that we each can make a contribution to a more beautiful, more whole society and world.
Thank you for that. That was beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
I really enjoyed the conversation. I wish you peace and love to your family, and especially to your charm.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Be well. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rabbi. Better change up your perspective. It's something new. Hope you guys enjoyed the show today. Remember our little talk before the show? Yep. Don't forget to subscribe, like, follow, share, all that jazz. It matters, people. You matter. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.